Last week we explored some of the core issues in Tefillat HaDerech. So what we'll do is we'll do a quick sum up, and then today will be a short share, and just I want to make a few observations halacha l'masa. We'll look at the Shulchan Aruch and explore some of the contemporary issues with regard to Tefillat HaDerech, not really in too much depth, just a few ha'arot, and that'll conclude our discussion of Tefillat HaDerech. So just to remind ourselves, last time we saw the primary sugya with regard to Tefillat HaDerech, this line in particular that was striking, Himalich b'kon chavetze, and then a series of other issues with regard to the text of the prayer, the question of singular versus plural, the need for the question as to when one davens, and the issue of ad kama ad parsa, and then the question of one's comportment during the tefillah, standing versus walking, a discussion of Rav Sheshes and Rav Chista. We then explore the underlying nature of Tefillat HaDerech. We ask whether it's a mere bakasha, a bakasha for protection, a bakasha even for success on the purpose, the ultimate destination of my journey, or is it more than that? Is it a matir for myself to put myself in danger and to embark on this journey in the first place? The language of the bracha, the text of the bracha, might sound more like protection on the one hand, but at the same time, the Gemara's language of Himalech v'kon chavetzeh, especially exemplified by Rashi's Tol Rishus, really led us toward more of a matir kind of approach. We suggested as well that the Maharsha and the Tzach and the respective commentaries in the Gemara may be divided on this issue as well. We then turned to the question of Ad Kama Ad Parsa, and we saw that there's a wide-ranging machloket harishonim, Agaonim Rishonim, in regard to what exactly this means. We saw two basic positions last time. I'd like to add a variation on one of them as well that's new. Basically, we said that the Bahagas cited by Rashi and Daf Lamed Aleph understands that it means what is the minimum amount of journey that is required for one to say Tefillat HaDerech, whereas Rashi understood that it's not a question so much of, or at all, with regard to what the journey ultimately will be, but rather it's a question of how far into the journey is it still appropriate for one to recite Tefillat HaDerech, and to that, the Gemara answers Ad Parsa. We then saw that within Rashi, there's a subsequent machloket harishonim as to how to understand him. The face reading of Rashi, the Rosh, and other rishonim understand that Rashi's intention, I believe the Ritva as well, understand that Rashi's intention is that ad parsa v'sula, after that we cannot recite the brach at all, whereas Rabbi Yonah understood that no, that b'dievet, just like Talos, Tefillin, etc., brachos ha-mitzvah, one can continue to recite it b'dievet after the fact, just continue to wear it, because you'll continue to fulfill the mitzvah, so too, according to Rashi, b'dievet, you can continue to recite the bracha afterward as well, and that was the position of the Rashba along the lines of Rashi. We then, within the position of Rashi, we analyzed this debate and we suggested that the more or in particular, we asked why, according to Rashi, especially according to the Rosh, would we be so severe? Why is it that we cannot compare it to Talos, Tefillin, etc.? Well, we saw that although the Pnei Yehoshua explains that it's really just a function of Bechezkat Sakana, that you're not Bechezkat Sakana until, that you're Bechezkat Sakana right away, but then he's going to lose his focus, his kavan later in the journey. We said that Rashi L'shitaso, I think, makes the most sense to explain the basis of the Meiri, who said that after a parsa, Visham Ve'ilah, says Miri inzen nimlach bekono ve'ena umra, that it's too late to say, it's no longer a matir. So precisely because it's a matir, Rashi L'shitaso says you have to say it as early as possible in the journey. That's the 3-minute summary of what we saw last time. I wanted to add before we jump to the halach l'masa that it's noteworthy that there's another view among the Rishonim as to what this means. The Rosh understands similarly to Rashi, but he inverts the timing of Ad Parsa. In other words, the Rosh claims that Ad Kama Ad Parsa means that one can continue to recite Tefillat HaDerech until the final Parsa of the journey. Right? So it's conceptually similar to Rashi in that Ad Kama Ad Parsa does not modify the overall length of the trip, but rather is relative to my place in that journey. But as opposed to Rashi, who says that it's talking about the first parsa of the trip, the Rosh says it's actually talking about the last. Ad parsa, until there is a parsa remaining in my journey, I can still recite Tefillat HaDerech. So that's how the Rosh understands what the Gemara has in mind. Okay. What would be the svara for that? So again, if right there you already could understand it, either based on, I think, a bakasha approach, or even within the matir approach. So the bakasha approach, I think it's pretty straightforward. You're basically done. It's a slap in God's face, right? So you've traveled 17 miles, right? And then you have just the final parsa. You're almost there, right? And now you're going to turn to God and ask for protection, safety, etc. Is chutzaf, right? Quite arguably, and therefore just an inappropriate bracha. And even certainly right within Rashi, I think it makes sense as well that you can hold like the Rabbeinu Yonah's understanding within Rashi, that claim that maybe lechatchila should be as early as possible, or admit, right, that you can really ask for that permission at any point along the way. But if you're literally within a stone's throw of your destination at that point already, it doesn't make any sense. A variation on that would be to say that within the parsa of your destination, it's no longer considered dangerous. There's someone suggests that the parsa within each city's respective limits is just simply not considered to be dangerous. Within a certain amount of space, the wild animals, in particular the listim, are not active because they're too close to the police force and so on and so forth. So that's just a variation on, and that again could work within both the matir and the bakasha approach. In other words, whether it's that I'm asking permission to intervene myself or it's that I'm actually asking for protection, the point is, if I'm within a parsa of the city, it doesn't really make very much sense to ask for either of those because at this point I'm really out of harm's way.
Well, in saying that, he's also saying what's considered a dangerous journey that requires, I mean, he's giving you the minimum amount.
Why?
If you go less than a parsa, then you...
Oh, you're saying, yes, you're saying that
he's giving you the minimum
amount. The rush would probably also be with the Bahag, in other words. Even though the rush's primary point is...
Maybe it works better in context of the Gemara,
right,
the rush, but I think at the same time he's agreeing with the Bahag.
Right, that could be, but just to push back, it's possible that he would disagree with the Bahag. So for example, he could make the argument that within one parsa of leaving the first city and another parsa of arriving at your destination, you need to count both of those. Maybe the rush could argue, even if you accept that Svara, could conceivably require a minimum two parsos, because you're not, right, we're not within danger in on either side.
Meaning like the Mishnah and the Ninth Perek, that Hanifas Lakrat.
That you say a second, you say the you two brachos or four brachos.
Right,
right.
Is that what that means?
No, I think that no, there's that is just really about maybe the arrival and then the journey when you're leaving, I think.
Uh-huh, you're saying it's two separate things.
Right. This here, what I'm saying is that for this one journey, I don't need protection during the first parsa away from the first city and this first parsa, the final parsa within the second city's limits. So, at minimum, the rush might require, if he has a minimum amount for the journey, it might be two parsos rather than one. If we're already going to operate under the assumption that the rush as far as on the basis of the argument that there's no danger within the first, or not sufficient danger within the first part, the parsa surrounding the city, which is not mukhrach, but even if you say that's far within the rush, I think he might still disagree with the Bahag and require a minimum of two parsos, if he has such a minimum.
Okay.
So he might... Right. Okay. Fine. So if you take a look at the Shulchan Aruch, so most of the issues in the Mechaber are issues that we've touched on. There's one issue that we did not, but let's just actually just read through. It's a relatively short section of Shulchan Aruch. I think it's worth reading quickly in its entirety. So the Mechaber addresses these issues in context of Hilchot Tefillah, interestingly enough, in Siman Kuf Yod and Orach Chaim, Seifim Dalid through Zion. So in that context, the Mechaber writes, If Dalit Hayosa Adarach Yisbalel, Yerushalom V'nechashem V'lekinu V'keyav Sinishit V'lekinu Shalom V'chulo, V'tzarech Lo'om Rabba Lashon Rabim, so that's just straight from the Gemara, right? That's Abaye's comment, that Lo'olam Lishati finish Bahadim, Tzibura, etc. V'im Efshar Ya'amod Milelech Kishayom Rena, so he says, Im Efshar you should stop, V'im Hayarochiv in Tzarech Le'red. And if he was riding, if he was journeying already, then he does not need to descend. So just to, we'll take each seif and then unpack it, and then when we're done, we'll add some sort of meta-observations about contemporary recitations of Al-Adarach. So with regard to this seif, so the first point is a straightforward one, that Tzarech La'om Rabba Lashon Rabim. There's an interesting discussion among the Achronim, b'di'evet, if one recited Tfilat Hadarach, is what b'lashon yachid, is one yotzei or not. So I believe the Mishnah Berurah already says that you have to take the Evan and a number of Achronim say that. So there, it's an interesting question. To what extent was Abaye's statement li'ikuva? Of course, one should preferably recite Tefillat Hatzibur, Tefillat Haderech rather, or any formal tefillah in a come on in Talmud Torah. Okay, of course, one should certainly recite a tefillah. Ideally, B'lashon Rabbim. There's no question about that. But let's say if the Yavid one recited a B'lashon Yachid. What's the halacha?
Why is it ideal you should recite a B'lashon Rabbim?
I don't, well, either, whatever the reason, the Gemara says so. That's what the Gemara said, right? That's what we reviewed, right?
Tatsi,
etc., etc. Rabbi says no, that it should be done in plural. So I think it is an interesting kind of question. There's a larger issue here as well. In other words, is this the ideal? Is it essential? If I don't include Klal Yisrael in my formal tefillah, is that ma'akev my tefillah? Is it so fundamentally lacking that it's not a legitimate tefillah at all?
This
is a very interesting question.
No, my question is, why is the Gemara phrase it as Tatsi Deini?
The Gemara rejects it, and the Gemara rejects it. Well, it's a personal. You're saying, what? You mean Tatsi Deinu?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Maybe a Raya that's not in the Tilos Rishus.
No. I'm asking
me as a permission.
I'm asking you, when I say we pray for individual.
That's interesting.
We pray for individual Bakashos. Then why wouldn't we.
Right. Although, in Shmona Esrei, everything's in the plural. So what some of the Rishonim say is that if. There's a distinction between a spontaneous prayer and a formalized text. If it's spontaneous, you don't have to ask, right? If I just if on the spur of the moment, right, I say Tehillim and I ask a bakasha, what?
I knew you were Breslov or Ahad.
Right, so that's Breslov?
Spontaneous prayer.
My friend.
There's no such time
limit.
It's just all.
So then there's no obligation or arguably even halachic preference to say Lashon Rabbah.
Right, no, I'm saying that.
Right. Why? Because.
What are you saying about?
Because the point is, there are different ways to explain it, but I think the simplest explanation of the Gemara is that it goes to our mindset as Jews. So, for example, the Gemara says that any time, right, the Gemara in Tanis and Daf Yud Aleph, right, that anyone who doesn't mourn together with the Tzibur won't be Zovroa B'Simcha. So that any time we think about our individual needs, we should always appropriately be mindful of the larger community's needs.
Right, Korban Torah is even with.
Right, so on the flip side as well, whenever one rejoices and Sheva Brachos, right, take place with a minion. We don't go on a honeymoon, and so on and so forth. So, at least not for the first week, which I think is a really, I mean, think about it, it's a very countercultural move. What? It's also, right, alternatively, it's because there's a minhag to exhaust the chatan and kala to the point of
right
complete, so that is when they can start off their marriage on the right foot. So, anyhow, so. No, but in other words, right, the point is we're willing to exhaust them because of the fundamental value of participating with the community, right, as the initiative in Chizkunis say with regard to, I think it's not Chizkunis, it's right now, with regard to the carbon tumet. So the question is how fundamental is that value, and I think that's part of the issue here. But I think that's something that's interesting to consider as well. It's also relevant, just since you're teaching the ninth parak, it's relevant for Birchot HaShachar, I think, as well. Right? In other words, it goes to this question, the Machlokes HaRishonim, as to whether you're saying it for your own personal experience of putting on clothing and waking up and opening your eyes, etc., or is it really for the entire society? So the Minhag Sfarad is that it's really a completely individual hodah, right? It's a different kind of tefillah, right? That's a Berachas Shavach hodah, but still. Right? Or is it on the community, which is the Minhag Ashkenaz? Right? Tosos, the Rosh, the Rama, etc. So that's something to consider as well. Okay. Then the Mechaber continues, V'im efshar yamod milelech kishe yomrena. So if at all possible, a person should try to stop and stand. So this goes to a dual question from the Gemara. Number one, how do we paskin with regard to the Mechelket Rav Sheshet and Rav Chista? And number two, how do we understand Rav Sheshet's decision to to follow the position of Rav Chisda in that story with his servant. So in regards to the Psak, Tosos already on this spot quotes a machloket between him and the Rif as to the value of Tosos and the Rif as to how we paskin, whether we hold like Rav Sheshis and Rav Chisda. Part of it again is how do you understand Rav Sheshis's decision to defer? That's part of the issue. But then again, even if we follow the position of Rav Shesha, which it seems the Mechaber is indeed doing here, and that seems to be the majority view among the Rishonim, the question is, was Rav Shesha just deferring out of a sense of pure Derech Eretz, but it did not bear halachically on his view? Or rather, when he said, Miotov al tikarei Rav, was he saying, in fact, that given that someone of the stature of Rav Chisda was the one who maintained this view, so even though my fundamental inclination is to disagree, nonetheless, I think it's best to try to bend over backward and stop if at all possible. Which is also an ambiguity with regard to the Gemara, and also some discussion among the Rishonim about that issue. The Mechaber seems to hold, like Rav Sheshet, on the more deferential, or right, the moderated version of Rav Sheshet, which he says it's appropriate for one to be Machmir for the view of Rav Chisda. Now, contemporarily, the second line, or the final line of the Mechaber, is particularly important, Chaim Rochev, in Tzarech Leireit. In other words, there's a distinction between one who's walking and one who stops. This is also, this already emerges from some of the Chachmei Ashkenaz that the Beis Yosef quotes. So this is an important point. In other words, right, that the Mechaber is adding, halacha lemasa, that all this is true. Rav Sheshis and Rav Chisda are discussing a case where my journey is by foot. So they're already, presumably the point is, I may not, if I'm walking and I'm avoiding whatever it is that I'm trying to avoid along the way, so I may be distracted, and therefore it's best for one to stop, recite Tefillah HaDerech, and then to continue, assuming that that's the Svar HaMachloket, which, although I think you could be creative and say other things, that's generally the way that the Rishonim understood it. So if that's the case, when one is riding, so then already that's a different story. And then one can make the argument that one who is, right? Now, you could have disagreed with that and said, no, I'm guiding the horse. And maybe then there's a distinction between the driver and the passenger. You can see why this is highly relevant nowadays. If I'm driving, do I have to pull over on the side of the road? Right, so at first glance, you might have said that it's lechatchila for me to pull over. Now you might say, well, that's very nice, but it can be dangerous to pull over on the side of the road. Okay, sometimes it is. It's not always dangerous to pull over on the side of the road while I'm driving within that first parsa, etc. So that's a little bit of a question. It's not 100% clear. But the fact that the Mechaber says in Meir Rochev in Tzarech Leireit would lead us to the conclusion that one need not necessarily pull over nowadays, not only if it's dangerous, but even if it's safe to pull over, one can see that it might not be required, and that's the consensus view, and which is why people generally don't pull over nowadays. Otherwise, really, according to the Mechaber, we should defer to Rav Chisda, pull over to the side of the road and Tzatzvi Asadera. That's not what we do, and it's on the basis of this final codification of the Mechaber.
Or you say, Rochev, because the horse is walking, but driving is more like Halech when you need to be watching where you're going.
Right. You could go even further, saying you could. I was suggesting that maybe driving is similar to, in that you have to.
Right, on the face of it, it sounds like it would be similar to riding.
Right.
But I'm saying maybe it's more similar to walking if the reason you have to stop is so that you don't trip.
Yeah, I have not journeyed on a donkey or a horse or otherwise recently, so I don't know how it compares. I imagine you probably didn't want to look down or be distracted. I guess you're saying the pace of the journey.
You're saying
especially if it's a slower pace.
It's a slower pace, and the horse has consciousness to not walk, right, at least, you know, off mm-hmm. the cliff.
If it's properly trained, presumably, as if you're making a real journey with it, hopefully it is, so then.
Right, whereas driving might be more comparable to walking, where you are
mm-hmm.
in control.
Good. That's a great point as well. That's, again, not generally what's assumed, but I think it's a legitimate point. Okay, Seif Hei. Ein lomar asa l'pam achatz b'yom, afilu im yanuach bo'ir be'emsa hayom. Aval da'ato l'olun bo'ir v'yachar kach nimlach v'yatsa mimena lavor chutza lo l'shul b'veitau, tzorech ha'chazur l'spal asa pa'am acharetz. Okay, so this is an important psak as well. So the Mechaber says here, the question is, what kind of, started to discuss this last time, what constitutes a second trip or a separate trip? Right, so we're talking about the very end. It's a new maaseh, right? It's a new event of a trip, but not a new event of a trip. How do we define that? So the basic psak of Shulchan Aruch is that it's once a day, although we have a notion of hesed chadas. So just as if I started eating my apple and then decided not to eat anymore, and then I changed my mind and decided to eat the apple again, I make another ha'et, and as applicable to other areas of halacha, so the same thing here as well. that if I decided to stop my trip and then I changed my mind and chose to continue, so then already the halacha is that one requires a new bracha. The other point that's relevant is that the Mechaber says that it's once a day. So now there's an interesting question. Let's say, for example, one travels through the night. Like, is this a din in Yom Valayla? Is it a din that, is the halacha that every that Alot HaShachar of a new dawning day defines this as a new journey, and therefore that is Mechayiv a new Tefillat HaDerech? Right? Or is the point that no, that if you spend the night, if you basically, the day is your time for journeying, the night is when you stop, you pull over, especially back in the day, right? There's a little no chance that they were journeying through the night, but it's not fundamentally a distinction between day and night, right? Mashma Adavra Doma, arguably, Birchat HaTorah, right? And the simple understanding is Birchat HaTorah is not fundamentally a function of day versus night. The point is, when it's the daytime, so then hopefully we aspire to the view of Rabbi Yitam, and then on some level, I'm constantly involved in Talmud Torah, whatever that means, or at least that's what I'm ideally meant to be. Okay, fine, that's while I'm conscious. But while I'm unconscious, while I'm sleeping, that's a different story, right? And as much as we want you to be dreaming about the Bam Kasha and Tesva, and halachically it doesn't quite work in that way. So, interestingly enough, the Vilna Gaon actually here, and as commentary Shulchan Aruch, actually, Nagos actually compares this to, draws the parallel to Birchat HaTorah, and that indeed seems to be the simple understanding. It's not a function of day-night per se, but rather a function of when one pauses in their journey. So that again, nowadays, when I'm journeying through the night, right, I'm taking a plane flight that goes through the night. I'm taking an overnight car trip with my family, whatever it may be. So if I drive through the night, then one can make a strong argument that that would not justify a new Tefillat HaDerech. Same thing for a pit stop, by the way, in the middle of the day. On a simpler case, if I'm just taking a brief stopover, right, that doesn't require new bracha, and it also likely does not split up the trip so that it's considered two separate nisiot. Right? So we're gonna discuss that's a different story.
You were still b'shem traveling.
Right. In other words, I'm on the turnpike and I pull over at the rest station.
Right.
And let's say there's going to be a question we're going to have to see in a few minutes. What is the minimum amount for the trip? Right. You have to pull over.
Amount of
distance. Yeah.
Not time stopped.
No, a minimum length of the trip.
Like, even if you stop and rest...
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, I'm elaborating it. Yeah.
Right. That would continue. Like, even if I drive to Newark and stay there... So they get on the plane and then go home.
That already might be different because they are already, those are, in a sense, halachically, you can view them as two different trips. I'm traveling to Newark and I'm traveling back from Newark. You leave, and that's how we think about it, right? If you, right, you get your plane ticket, you have a destination, and then you have, right? Well, and you do the same thing again. You get back in the car, you get back in the plane, you disembark. I think we consider those as two separate.
What if I'm driving you to Newark?
Okay,
say one bracha only include returning.
That's right. True, but we say
all.
That's true, but we also again we don't. Right.
Who's asking from the Lysa?
No, I understand. The general practice, I hear that. I think that the point is that whenever we're saying these brachot, we then sometimes broaden the discussion to include others, other requests. In other words, even the fact that we ask for success on our destination, I think is probably not the primary function of the tefillah. The haraya doesn't appear until the very end, and it almost feels like an afterthought. Right? It required the marshal to kind of highlight it. So my suspicion is that that's generally considered to sort of be...
secondary.
It's like it's an add-on, but it's not the primary thrust of the tefillah, and therefore wouldn't qualify one. I think that that's a general assumption. I believe. As you'll see, I'm not a huge Tefillat HaDerech reciter in general, at least in America. So for me, it's not as relevant. But we'll get there.
Do you say we're traveling to New York? No.
I don't.
Neither do I.
What?
I
many do. I don't. As outline.
Because of an entire parcel that's not inhabited?
That's a piece of it, but not even the primary piece. But outline. Okay, just to continue. Sif Vav, Harami Rutenberg, Jahaya Yotzila, Derech Babokar, Yomra Chari, Hiratsum, Gila Smicha, Verka, Gomelchasim Tavim, Vitia Bracha, Hasmucha, Lachaverta. So the Maharami Rutenberg was actually, and this is the one piece that we haven't really seen echoes of at all yet in our discussions, the Maharami Rutenberg had the following chumra. His practice was that he would, instead of just reciting Tzvila Derech whenever, I'm familiar with this, he would recite it immediately following the Yihi Ratzon, or what we call Vihi Ratzon, which includes Hagamal Chasem Tavim Lama Yisrael, for the purpose of rendering this a bracha smucha lachaverta. What's going on here? What's the background? So this is based on the general sugya of bracha smucha lachaverta. In particular, the most prominent source probably about this issue as the Pais Tzvila Derech is a Tosfot off from Sachem and Daf Kuftalad, where Tosfos has a lengthy discussion about bracha smucha lachaverta in general. And there's a machloket Rishonim and Tosfot among other Rishonim as well as to whether or not it's problematic to recite Tfilat HaDerech with the current text as it stands. On the one hand, that is the current text. On the other hand, it seems to be problematic that we begin Tfilat HaDerech without Sheimu Malchut, Baruch Atah Hashem, right, Elokeinu Melech Olam, or something along those lines, right, and then jump into the Hiratzon of Tfilat HaDerech. Because after all, as a general matter, we do not recite random standalone brachot without, in the form of a tefillah kitsara without a bracha at the beginning, right? Unless it's a bracha smucha lachaverta. So the question among the Rishonim is, right, is it problematic to recite tefillah hadarech without appending it to another bracha? And why is it formulated in this way? Does that reflect the fact that it was originally inserted into Shema Tefillah? That's why in Shemoneh Esrei, and that's why it concludes Shema Tefillah. Right, what exactly is going on? So there's a big discussion among the Rishonim. Some hold that's an exception and doesn't follow the general rule. I don't want to sidetrack us by just getting into the whole sugya of bracha smucha lachaverta. But the bottom line is that it's a machloket among the Maalei HaTosfos. The Maharami Rutenberg had the practice to do it in this way. Other people just say shakol niyam bidvara or something like that when you're already in the car. And this is where it comes from. This is where it appears in Shulchan Aruch. Just to point out, in light of the fact that it's machloket harishonim and the language of the Mechaber methodologically, it's not 100% clear how he means to paskin. In other words, when he says the Maharam did X, right? That's like a yesh omrim, right? So the kind of methodological issue that some of those kinds of the Achronim who deal with this kind of question, how do we methodologically approach such a comment of Shulchan Aruch that raises? So Rav Avadia, you know, these kinds of things, and many others before him as well. So the general consensus among the Achronim, including the Shemura, is that this is the preferred course of action, but if you don't have an apple or a cup of water and you forgot to insert it earlier, in other words, you don't have an excuse, you don't have to go to the restroom or don't have a restroom accessible, and so on. In other words, you don't have another bracha to which to be masach this bracha, that one can still legitimately recite Tfilat HaDerech with Sheimu Malchut, even when not juxtaposing it to another bracha. But this, the actions of the Maharam are considered to be the lechatchila.
I just want why there was a concern not to have it by itself.
Why it could be problematic?
Yeah.
Because it's questionable whether or not one can recite a tefillah kitsara that does not open with Sheimu Malchut, whether it's legitimate for the bracha,
okay,
right, as a standalone. So, for example, benching, right? So the first bracha is Baruch Atah Hashem, right, etc. Noda and Rachem, right, jump in right away because it's Bracha Smucha Lechaverta, and therefore it can appear in the format, the mapeh of its tefillah kitsara rather than a tefillah arukah or bracha. So it sounds like it's because it was presumably said in context of another tefillah originally. That could be part of the argument.
Like Noda and Rachem.
And that's what some people say in Shemoneh Esrei, depending on the trip. The reason not to do it that way is because of the next line in Shulchan Aruch, which we're going to have to see, but that's part of the question. And then, by the way, right, Kel Avinu, that's already an exception. That's like a new bracha entirely. It's Rabbanon, the first year of Doraita, invention, I'm saying. Right. Uvnei Yishlaim, Gojim, Rav Yemein, Racha, right, Bnei Racha, or Bnei Yishlaim, Amen, right, that's the point you're on now, Amen Achara, to separate between the two. So it's a new start, and that's why that has its own bracha. Okay, and then the Mechaber concludes, Sif Zayin, Omer Otah, this is fascinating, and this is subject to some subtle discussion among the Rishonim, it's not 100% clear, Achar Shehechezik Baderach. So the Mechaber's preference, this is not at all obvious, is that one should not do what I was suggesting earlier to say in Shemoneh Esrei, right? But rather, once you've already begun the journey, not at all obvious in the Gemara, Ad Kama Ad Parsa, right? Certainly within Rashi, right, it doesn't sound that way. We did mention, though, that the Rashba's explanation of Rashi specifically indicates that l'chadchila one should recite it dafka within the first parsha, not prior to that. So Amar Ta'ach Asher Echzik Baderech, right? Why would that be? Right? It's again, it's counter to the obvious explanation of Rashi, but presumably it's something akin to, right, the general notion of Overla Siyatan. It's not obviously Overla Siyatan in the Birchat HaMitzvah sense, but in other words, my bracha needs to be chal on the chefza on which I'm reciting a bracha. So, for example, right, if I don't have, right, an apple, right, if the apple is in the other room, I'm going to go get it, it's questionable whether I can recite a bracha, right? It should presumably be in your hand. Even water fountains, right, is the question with regard to, right, if you have to turn on the water before you start. There's literally the real tshuva written about this issue. Right, and so on and so forth. What?
Otherwise, it doesn't work. You
know? Otherwise, it doesn't. It could be a tefillat shav. Okay, so the right. So that's presumably where he's coming from, but it's a very important point that it appears that way in Shulchan Aruch. So Omerta Sherech Zek Vaderech Ve'im LaOmra Elam Kin Yish Lo Leilich Parsa. So he says. Now we get into the Rashi, Behag, etc. issues. So you should only say it if you're planning to walk a parsa. So that's what Shita. You should only say it if you're planning to walk, if your journey is a parsa length. Right? Rashi quoting, right? The Behag, remember, according to the Behag, it's about the journey itself, and according to Rashi, it's how far into the journey, because of the matzir point. Right? Okay. Ve'in la omra elam kin yish l'leich parsa, so he passes like the Behag, v'al pacha mi parsa lo yachton bivracha. Okay, good. And then he adds, or the Ramadli says, "U'l'chadchil yomer asa b'farsa rishona." Rashi v'ari. Right. So then he says, "U'l'chadchil at least you should say within the first farsa." Either because he's just being machmir for Rashi, or because that's actually Rashi's shita. Right. The re, I think, here means Rabbi Yona. So then it would be the latter of those two possibilities. Right. V'emshachach mila omra yomer asa kol zman shibaderach ovavad shelo yia tok parsa smucha la'ir shirotza la'lunba. Right, umisham ve'elach yomar asa b'lo bracha. So then the last point is, he passes like whom? That's why I mentioned it today earlier in Shir, the Rosh. Right, so Shulchan Aruch kind of, right, as his cake needs it too. He basically paskins like all the shitos through Rishonim, one way or another, if you add the Raman, at least, at minimum, right, with regards to this issue, which is interesting, although I don't think there's a steer necessarily. There's an interpretive difference of opinion, but not necessarily a conceptual difference of opinion. Therefore, I think it's legitimate to paskin in that way. Okay. Good, so that's the Shulchan Aruch. I just wanted to add to this discussion, and we kind of touched on it a little bit as well, that in contemporary terms, there are a number of key questions that arise with regard to Tefillat Hadarach Bazman Hazeh, in light of a number of fundamental changes. The most obvious one is changes in form of travel, but also changes with regard to level of danger and the nature of danger that one encounters. Certainly if one is in safer areas. So even, right, so differences one can argue between, for example, for our purposes, America, for the most part, most of the places will travel in America, with the exception of contemporary Baltimore. Those who have followed the news. So the distinction between America and Israel itself, obviously, like in any country, but Israel, it's just particularly familiar and acute. And generally speaking, will be similar, depending, right, across different days that I'm going to journey. Although, even then, things happen and places flare up. So that's I think an important right. So those are both key distinctions between the way that things were and the way that things are. So how did those differences bear on contemporary recitation of Tefillat Hadarach? So there are a couple of key issues that the poskim discuss. One key issue is this question of the minimum trips. The Mechaber poskens, and we assume take for granted that it's on parsa. Parsa is 4 mil. Which I think comes out to roughly something like 3 miles, I believe, something like that, in contemporary measurements. So the question is, right, is that really the minimum amount that we're talking about for our purposes, right? What's the minimum trip distance that one has to travel to recite Tefillat Hadarach? Was that a firm takanat chazal, which even if in contemporary times are right, or forms of travel are different, such that you might have, if Chazal were misakin it nowadays, maybe they would have misakin it differently, but that was set in stone, and therefore that continues to be the proper amount. Or, no, what Chazal said is a minimum, a substantial journey, or maybe a journey that tends to be dangerous, which is one measure of that can be existence. Although there are probably better measures, but certainly in terms of the potential for car accidents and so on and so forth, a certain minimum distance, right? Even though they say that most accidents happen within 5 miles of home, so that's what they say, right? But that's because most, I think it's because most of your driving happens within 5 miles of your home. So I think that's a skewed statistic that if it's an unhelpful statistic if they're a Muslim. And they're not measuring the level of danger involved. So, like, in other words, like I bumped into, right? Like they're counting like I bumped into the fire hydrant.
The deadly accidents are probably more likely on the highway.
Right. So I don't know how it's such a relevant statistic for our purposes, but those are the kinds of questions. So it's a very interesting discussion, and generally speaking, this is simplified, but Ashkenazim and Sephardim tend to have a difference in psak with regard to this matter. Ashkenazim, especially because of an important comment in the Mishnah Berurah, and Sif Katan Lamed addresses the issue of contemporary travel. He talks about the Misilat HaBarzel, right? So modern trains, right? So this is pretty interesting. So his suggestion, he says, he points out that even at the time of the Gemara, there were different speeds with regard to different forms of journey, right? So he says, on the second line, he says, V'in chiluk meholich besina leholich mayabasha. Right, citing the Elia Rabba, right? So if I'm walking in dry land and I'm journeying in a ship, those are very different kinds of speeds, right? My journey, and yet the same halacha of ad parsa applies, right? In the Bahag's on Bahag's understanding, he's a gam nosei amusar harbazel yishol levar tefilas haderech afilum nosei arach parsa. So the Shabur says explicitly that the halacha is that. Right, that it doesn't change, and his raya is because even at the time of Chazal it changed, and yet the Gemara gives a standard amount, so therefore nowadays the same halacha applies as well. And so he applies the regular halachot, the familiar halachot of Filat HaDerech, to we see in Mechaber Rama, etc., to all contemporary journeys. Rav Avadya and others disagree. It's a long tshuva. Rav Avadya says in the tshuva is an Orach Chaim Chilek Aleph. Simon Yugivel. I gave you just the conclusion of Rav Avadya. I thought that for the purposes of this little shir, a full tshuva of Rav Avadya was probably not the best of ideas. It's a little bit long. So at the very end in section, in Sekhatan Yud Gimel, in Simon Yud Gimel, right, his conclusion is that in fact, it depends on, he thinks that it was the Mahalach Arba Mil, which we generally assume to be 18 minutes for a mil, right, and so therefore 72 minutes. So the claim of Avadya is that a minimum journey of 72 minutes is necessary for a contemporary recitation of Tu'ah HaDerech. Any less than that, you can say it without Shema Malcha, but not with Shema Malcha. This whole discussion is about Shema Malcha. You can always say Yehi Ratzon, just like you can say any Bakasha that you want without Shema Malcha. But if you want to say Baruch Atah Hashem, Shemiat Tefillah, that's Rav Avadya's Sak, and given the influence, the outsized influence of Rav Avadya's contemporary Sephardic practice, that's why many follow this.
So that means even if you're driving 1 hour, not 72 minutes, you've gone 50
right.
miles, you don't say it?
Yep. That's,
and
that's
if you're, good. What if you're walking for an hour and a half?
If you are
walking for an hour and a half.
If you are walking for an hour and a half, it's 72 minutes.
You have to go, regardless of how far you walk.
It's not a question. The point is not, that's the whole distinction. It's a function of time rather than of distance. That's exactly the argument. Okay.
And does not take into consideration stuff or not?
That's what it would seem. Like that's a separate issue, but right.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. Right, 100%. Okay, so that's one huge contemporary issue. And then there's a second issue, which is what happens when the trip does not seem to be nearly as dangerous as it was back in the day. Listim, Oyev, Orev, Baderech, these were incredibly dangerous journeys. When I'm driving from New York to Philly, right, I'm not necessarily, right, all that nervous, right? If I'm driving in contemporary Israel, right, I probably am, and not just because there are people who might hurt me, you know, outside of the cars, right, or whatever, in other ways, but the terrorists, but also just because of, right, because of the dangers of driving, because the Israeli drivers as well. But these are You know, even that doesn't necessarily.
Okay, the drive. So argument within driving in New York City.
Right, and you can write, and you can kind of reduct you ad absurdum. That, although, I don't know, objectively it says dangerous. I don't think that that's, but part of the question is to what extent it's subjective versus objective, and what kind of danger we're talking about. Are we talking about, like, you know, someone?
People don't feel fear for their lives when they're driving in New York City.
No, they shouldn't. 30 years ago, they should, but that's a different kind of
question. But your car is not dying.
A pedestrian might fear for their life crossing in a light. That's a different issue. Right? All right, if you're driving, then no. But if you're... These are questions. So I saw quoted in the name of... it was a good source quoting Chabura that they heard from Rav Shechter. And Rav Shechter cited a debate between the Rav and Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, interestingly enough, on that issue. So speaking of New York / Boston and Philadelphia, I have the connections, I have all the connections here. So his client, and I've heard this cited in the name of the Rav, at least in other places as well, that the Rav basically thought that if you're not nervous, you shouldn't recite Tefillat HaDerech. My understanding is that the Rav did not recite Tefillat HaDerech when traveling from Boston to New York and back by plane. I've heard that. I can't promise.
You know my point.
Well, that's how we travel. Wow. That's my understanding, is that the Rav did not recite Tefillat HaDerech. He wasn't afraid.
Same, it's subjective.
No, you can say that that's objective as well, though. Again, I can't speak exactly for the Rav's position, but we know that the research shows that that accidents are more dangerous. Cars are more dangerous than planes. Again, I haven't done the control for the number of flights versus. Like, I don't know if it's by percentage or just overall.
No, it's by percentage.
Right. That's by percentage, so that for it's
sure.
objective.
For sure.
Okay, so then it's objective.
Over Ukraine.
The percentage of planes that people die on is like 0.0 something.
All right, so there you have it. So then, all right. Yaakov Kamenetsky apparently disagreed and held it was a takanas chazal. I don't know, the svara wasn't cited, but I assume that the point is, it's a form of takanas chazal, that's how they establish it, and that's how it works nowadays as well. Now, my personal practice is that...
Really?
What?
What? Now we're getting the meat and potatoes, the juice stuff here.
What? This is... I know, so I asked the Shaila when I was much younger, and I always thought that the Rav's perspective made a lot of sense. My personal practice is that I generally don't recite Tefillat HaDerech. Usually, I have someone else in the car, they'll usually want to recite Tefillat HaDerech. I'm not kofed on anyone. I'm not kofed on even on my wife.
I generally don't, on an average plane ride.
Ask me what I do when I go to Israel. I haven't gone to Israel for years, unfortunately. When I've gone in the past, I hadn't specifically planned to do it. My more recent plane flights that I would take, I would usually take it with someone else, and I've asked someone to be motzi me, and that was sort of my pshara.
Over the water?
What?
You're saying that's more because over the water?
Right. Right. I don't know. I haven't. When I would have the opportunity to take a serious plane flight again, which might take a couple of years until my kids grow up, or I don't know when that's going to happen next, so I would have to revisit it. I'm not sure. But when I'm going to New York, I personally actually don't recite it. The one downside I find, in Israel, though, I'm much more likely to say it. In Israel, I think it's much more common. There's sort of Tefillat HaDerech, to me, seems to be perhaps more woven into sort of the culture in Israel than in America. That's just my sense. I think there's something lacking that I often experience when I don't say Tefillat HaDerech and someone else, like my wife, wants to say Tefillat HaDerech, which is that there's this sense that when you say Tefillat HaDerech, the matir, the protect, whatever, the bakasha, etc., that it sort of it lends a sort of religious significance, if not to the journey itself, but sort of, you know, I think the notion that we're reciting brachot and thinking about these things ahead of those trips, I think, is a religious opportunity, and I think is a lost one if you hold that you shouldn't recite it. That said, I don't think that we should therefore make up, you know, if you think you shouldn't recite a bracha, then I don't think you should say it. But I often feel torn in the sense that I don't feel there's an obligation, but I almost feel like somehow my sort of spiritual awareness is lacking. And so One thing that I've been considering recently, but I haven't yet implemented, is to at least say it without Shem Malchut. The reason I don't usually do that is because typically I'll be traveling like with my family, and then we say it in that way. Anyway, but otherwise I'll be yotzei with someone else who's saying it. So that's where I stand on it. But I just wanted to observe that I think that there's something religiously lost when one does not recite it. Certainly on all sides on this issue. By the way, Shachianu is the same thing. I don't say Shachianu on many things at all. In major cities, I don't say Shachianu on a fruit on the first night, on the second night of Rosh Hashanah. If you're in a major city, because I don't think that they're on the what?
You say when you have a new fruit?
When you have the new fruit, I don't. I say Shechianu on that night because I think Mi'ikar Hadim we paskin that you say Shechianu. We do. It's just a chumrah. I just don't think that the new fruit is mechayvet. I don't say it on a new fruit that I haven't had for 30 days. I'm not the only one. I don't think Rabbi Sadlovsky does based on the shear that I recommend. Because it's not a function of is available in the supermarket nowadays in major cities.
So what do you say though?
So it's exactly the same thing, very uncommonly. If I bought a new car, right?
Bought a new car?
What?
A new computer.
You would say it on a car?
I would, I would say it on buying a new car. I would say it on buying a new house. I don't say it on a nice shirt. Because, I buy new shirts because, we have, a million shirts. You know, how many suits do I have that go through a year?
I don't know.
You know, what? What?
Maybe they have the fit.
How many do you have? What? I don't have that. I don't have that many. I don't have that many. But, you know, it's not a simcha. For most of us, it's not, maybe for Josh it is, but for most of us, it's not a simcha to buy a suit. It's not a simcha to buy a shirt. There's no din in Chazal that when you buy a new shirt, you say Shechianu. That's clear. Tu'an Hadarach, there's a question. With regard to Shechianu, it's quite clear that it's contextual. And with regard to the new fruit, it's not a function of my eating starfish for the first time in whatever, right?
Starfruit.
Very funny. Right, but it's a function of its availability in the supermarket. And if you're, if you're in a far off place, it's one thing. But if you're in if it's readily available all year round, so that's the world that we live in. It's very different. Again, it's not my psak only. It's a common psak in the last 20 years among major postcards. So that's it. All right, so that's my personal practice, but there are different opinions in Yeshua Mu'es Mochani, which way, but that's a quick summary. Yashar Khan.